I actually got so first got involved with SLAM in 96 when I transferred from SUNY Old Westbury to Hunter College. And I had transferred with the express purpose of joining SLAM because in 95 there's a huge student participation, as you know. We have, I think, about 25,000 people, and that kind of inspired me, and I knew that, you know, Hunter SLAM, you know, Hunter still SLAM chapters all around the city, you know, Hunter SLAM, you know, tended to be much more of the epicenter, from what I can see, you know, with, you know, having, like, publishing apparatus, you know, and, like, you know, just to organize this. Also, this, my brother went to Hunter, too, and so that kind of made it easier to choose. So in 96, I go to Hunter. And by 97, 98, I'm a member of the e-board of SLAM when they were in student government. I was a position of student affairs commissioner and also the editor of the Hunter College newspaper, the Envoy, one of the editors, along with Jen. Going before, like, R2K, you know, SLAM had this really long tradition, and, I wouldn't even call it a long tradition. I mean, it was a young organization, but I would definitely say it was, it definitely put itself out there as an organization that utilized direct action in its day-to-day existence. And I think that's one of the things that separated SLAM from other student organizing groups. Most of the organizing groups focus primarily on, like, you know, kind of like reform measures, you know, talking to politicians, that type of thing. Where SLAM, our primary focus was looking at really kind of using, you know, nonviolent civil disobedience, creative actions as a day-to-day part of our organizing to galvanize the public. So even before, like, R2K happened, had a bunch of a group of seasoned veterans who were, you know, who were engaged in direct action around, like, issues around, like, open admission to City University, police brutality in the community, you know, to give kind of sense of the time, put in context. I mean, you know, Amadou Diallo is was shot 41 times. There's 41 days of civil disobedience. You know, and SLAM members took part in that. You know, in front of one police plaza in New York City. You know, we had SLAM members who were part of civil disobedience in defense of City University, disrupting board trustee meetings. And in 1999, in defense of Mumia Abu-Jamal, we took over the Liberty Bell July 4th, 1999. SLAM members, about 40 of us, and all together about 417 people, were arrested that day surrounding the Liberty Bell. It made national and international news. When you come down to 2000, there was already a seasoned cadre of, you know, 20-something activists who had already been arrested, who had already spent time in jail, who had already, done that kind of preparation work, in relationship to direct action.
I remember that, you know, we had a lot of experience with, like, the police picking people off at our protests in the street. So we had, like, in some ways we were sort of seasoned around that sort of, like, what you need to do when there is a lot of repression and, like, trying to protect each other from protest, from arrest, even if it was, like, you know, physically grabbing each other to unarrest each other. Like, I feel like we had so much experience with that, like, tactical, street tactical stuff, too.
Yeah, you had talked about unarrest. I mean, there was a whole time, that reminds me, we didn't just go out there just, like, kind of willy-nilly and just be like, oh, arrest us, you know, we just a dump out the street. I mean, it was a whole type process and training that went through, and really, like, it was interesting. It was also just training in terms of consensus organizing, Because in order for you to do these type of actions, you really need to trust the people you're with. And you really need to build a sort of bond in a relationship with the folks that you're dealing with. So, I mean, there's a reason why they call it an affinity group. You know what I'm saying? Like people you like.
Yeah.
So in terms of like that training, I mean, I remember like, for example, like at the Mumia demonstration, there was a whole entire like conversation and like wrangling around, what kind of language we're going to use, you know, like what we're going to do if a police attacked us, what we're going to do in terms of like the messages we want to put out, what we're going to do in case people came and said some racist shit, you know, how we're going to defend each other, you know, and how we're going to care for each other. And that was a big thing. Cause it was really about, it wasn't just like performa, but it was also just about taking care of each other.
Wow, that's so important for like the stuff with R2K, because it did end up with a lot of like traumatic things happening, and we really had to take care of each other. What inspired you to participate in R2K, like in Philadelphia? Or, you know, was it related to the fact that it was going to be about police in prisons, or was that something that, like, because I remember that was, like, a process also, like, of arguing for that, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a couple of things. I mean, one thing, we just have to put it in kind of historical context a little bit, right? What was happening the year before R2K even happened was the Battle of Seattle. And before that, I mean, there were, all, like, the stuff that happened with SLAM was happening this nationally. There was a huge upswing in terms of like student activism. There was a huge interest in terms of anarchism, and there was a huge interest in terms of direct action. You know, this that was popping off just nationally, particularly in like the different city centers of New York City, Chicago, and San Francisco, and you know, and it all culminated, you know, with the famed, you know, Battle of Seattle. Which kind of inspired, like, you know, hundreds of, like, young people around the country, not thousands of young people, in terms of, like, taking, like, you know, direct action seriously. So within that context, the second part of that, too, was the fact that, you know, there was an election in 2000. This was coming at the end of the Bill Clinton administration. You know, Bill Clinton... You know, even though he's lauded by many, he was responsible for the mass imprisonment of, you know, of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of African Americans and Latino people. You know, he ended welfare support for welfare mothers. You know, and so there was this whole entire concept of this kind of like benign capitalism that Clinton represented, and that was coming to a close. And there was a battle between George Bush and Al Gore. So 2000 was an election year. And the Republican National Convention, you know, they decided to hold their convention in Philadelphia, you know, which is very symbolic in terms of, quote-unquote, the creative liberty for them. You know, for us, I mean, for political activists, we know Philadelphia as not as a creative liberty. We know Philadelphia is a place of Frank Rizzo parading Black Panthers naked in the streets at gunpoint. We know, Philadelphia is Wilson Good dropping a bomb on the Move Center and destroying entire square blocks of in the Black community. We know Philadelphia as the place in which Mumia was framed, Mumia Abu-Jamal, the famed journalist and writer and educator, was framed and for murder and placed on death row. So Philadelphia, so for us, so when you talk about what inspired me, you know, just to see the Republican Party and what that represents, you know, going to Philadelphia, was many of us took it as a direct challenge to us in terms of the work that we were doing in regards to freeing when we were with Jamal and making those connections in Philadelphia. So it was kind of a showdown on a national stage. To challenge the Republican Party, you know, on a national stage, and really kind of bring in those politics about prisons and political prisoners to the forefront of the national consciousness.
I feel like it was so unique that, like, the movement to free political prisoners, like, joined up with, like, the global justice movement. And in a way, sometimes I wonder if that's why the repression was so intense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that had a lot to do with it. And I think that people saw, and particularly the ruling classes, you know, in the state, the law enforcement saw the potential of a broad-based, movement connecting anti-globalization with political prisoners, with trade unions, with the peace movement, as being, you know, symbolic with a militant direct action core, as being threatening to, you know, to running business as usual. So if Philadelphia was successful, right, then there was going to be a sense that, there could be other successful movements around the other parts of the country as well. Now, you also have to put this in the context, too, that you had this guy who's a police commissioner at the time in Philadelphia, John Timothy, he was also a police commissioner in New York City when Amadou Diallo was killed, who was also brought on, I believe, as commissioner or advisor for the Miami protests that happened, the FTAA protests that happened earlier. Or maybe that happened afterwards. I think it might happen.
Yeah, the Miamian, they really crushed people then. Oh, my God.
Was that after or before CJ? I don't remember.
It was, I believe it was after R2K. It was like even, it might have been like 2 years later.
Yeah, you're right, actually, yeah. So, like, I felt like, so based on the Seattle experience, right, I think that the learning curve of the police department kind of grew exponentially. And I think that Timothy kind of represented that learning curve, you know, in terms of, like, what police tactics to use in terms of repressing folks, disrupt communication networks, you know, massive shows of force, basically militarize the city, using that as pressure points in terms of blocking or movement building.
Were you in the Papa Warehouse?
Was that? Yeah, I was in the Papa Warehouse. So basically, it was crazy. Like, I was a part of a team that was supposed to lock down a highway, I believe, or one of the major intersections of the street, and we were in the Papa Warehouse, and there were a bunch of slam folks there. And, you know, we were going back and forth between this church and the public warehouse and just kind of making preparations our time, you know, meeting, discussing, strategizing, figuring out what we're going to do. And, finally, you know, and they, so we're in a public warehouse, you know, and I forgot what we were talking about. I think we were arguing, actually. There was a lot of arguing. You have to understand that it was funny because it wasn't this one. Usually when we did action, it was just Slam. And Slam just kind of like did his thing, and then we went home, he got arrested, and, you know, called it a day. But now we're working with a whole bunch of, like, hundreds of, like, global justice activists and, like, white anarchists. And they definitely had a different style. I remember it was being a time that I first learned about, like, spokes councils. Like, I didn't even know what the hell that was, you know? Like, you know, the whole time thing of spokes councils and where, you know, people were kind of like meet in a circle and talk and, you know, and devise company groups. And there's a bunch of meetings, but, you know, but there's also this, like, kind of like also working differently in terms of racial dynamics as well. You know, like, Slam is a people of color, women-led organization, being in a situation where it's like, you know, we're looking with mostly like, you know, white anarchists, mostly from the Direct Action Network. So the idea was that, I remember going to the Puppet Warehouse, I think the idea was that, you know, the puppets would kind of make a parade down the street, and then, like, some of the puppets would have been used to, like, I think, not used, but, like, we would definitely, like, after the puppets did their day, we would then take the streets. It was crazy because we're sitting there arguing about, like, bike locks. You know, like, somebody was supposed to have a bike lock, and the bike lock never came because the bike lock was supposed to help us, like, lock down. You know, all of a sudden I hear this, like, this thumping noise, and I see everyone kind of running to the door, and they're blocking the door. And I'm like, what the fuck's going on? And someone shouts, oh, shit, we're getting raided. So people start locking the door and locking both the back door and the front door of the Puppet Warehouse. And it turned out we were surrounded by the police. The police were going to raid us. So,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So at this time, I'm, like, freaking out. And I remember because, like, what I remember so clearly was that Anna Ortega, we had these, like, plastic Ziploc baggies that had, we call it, like, handkerchiefs with, like, vinegar on them, vinegar and water, that we used to, in case they would shoot tear gas.
Right.
You know, so that way we can cover our eyes because they shot tear gas. So the vinegar and water apparently mitigates the effect of the tear gas. So, you know, so, like, the first thing I see is Anna take the baggie out and put it on her face.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, girl, what are you doing? And, like, the second thing I see these two white anarchists, right, take out these gas masks. And it was funny because there was an ordinance by the Philadelphia Police Department at the time saying that anybody caught with a gas mask would be arrested. Because, because the gas masks became very famous during the Seattle occupation. You know, like a bunch of folks had gas masks. So I was like, how come y'all got gas masks? I don't have a gas mask, you know?
Yeah, man.
So I was kind of in my back of my mind, I'm kind of cracking up about this, but so we're surrounded, right, by the police.
Hmm.
And, of course, the first thing we're thinking about is, we're going to do what activists do. We're going to have a meeting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're meeting about whether or not we should give ourselves up or we should just make a run for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, and it, you know, and when you're surrounded by the police, I mean, it's really not much of a choice you have.
Okay.
And the thing I remember that was so funny about that, too, was that as we were meeting, you know, and discussing this, the police never had a search warrant. And the shit was mad funny because they didn't have a search warrant. So technically, we could have, like, ran out or done something else or did something. But the thing about it was that within 3 hours, they were able to get a search warrant.
So the delay allowed them to get that search warrant and come in?
Exactly, yeah, they were just going to come in. So once that happened, and the thing about it that happened was, the funny thing that happened was afterwards, during what we were meeting, like Sandra was trying to moderate this meeting, and she was doing a great job, but it was just too much. So at some point, Sandra was like, you know what, y'all can just, I'm releasing my duty as moderation. You know, and then she was like, you know, and whatever. Because it was just too much arguing, you know? And then finally, given all that, we decided that we were going to march out, you know? Fist in the air, hands out high, and get arrested. So we got arrested, and they put us in these big steel bins. We also had all of us had, like, different code names.
And we also just, like, remember that, I also remember that, like, the popular culture part about it, too, was that the name of the affinity group that we had was called Red Pill Network. You know, after the Matrix, you know, take the blue pill or the red pill, you know, either the red pill, you know. But anyway.
So that was your, like, your small affinity group in that action? Because I remember it also was, like, with this listserv nationally, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
Yeah, so within a small group of affinity, we call ourselves the Red Pill Network. Yeah, the rest in Galesburg, I mean, that was kind of crazy. I mean, first of all, I mean, you have to understand, it was 110 degrees that day in Philadelphia. They had us in a school bus for, like, hours. And subsequently, I pass out. You know, I don't know what happened. I think I might have been dehydrated. I think, I don't know what happened, but, like, I just lost consciousness for, like 5 seconds.
Oh, my God. And so people advocated for you?
Yeah, so people advocated for me. And basically what happened was, I got dragged out of the bus, like, by my arms and my shirt and my hair. Like, I don't really remember. I used to have long hair back then.
Oh, that sounds painful.
Yeah, and they took me to the hospital. And I never gave up my information in the hospital. You know, I never gave them my name.
Because that's what we had decided, right?
Yeah, and they had me handcuffed to the gurney. And I just remembered, and that summer I read Asada's book. And I remembered, like, her talking about being handcuffed to the gurney.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
and it reminded me of Asada, you know. So they took me down. They checked me out. You know, it just turned out I just passed out for a few seconds. And they took me back to the roundhouse where I was in, where they put me in. They put me in jail in the cell. I was in the cell with a bunch of folks. That's the cell. That cell should have only fit 3 people at most. And we had about 5-6 people in that cell. So it was cramped. And I spent about 3 days in jail. And it was a really tough experience. I mean, it was like I suffer from very deep eczema. And like my eczema just kind of exploded that time and my skin was like really a mess. I couldn't sleep. And like there wasn't any like water or anything, and also I just kind of, and I also remember, like, you know, I was told that story, it was always kind of funny, but it was like they kept serving us this like Wawa, like iced tea and sandwiches.
Sandwiches?
Yeah, like cheese sandwiches. And I was just like, that shit is so nasty. You know what I'm saying? And every time I go to, like I say, every time I go to Philadelphia, I see Wawa, I just turn the other way.
Yeah.
I can't stand fucking Wawa. I hate it.
Yeah.
Oh, so.
I mean,
like,
iced tea doesn't,
also,
like, hydrate you. Like, if you need to be hydrated, like, iced tea is not going to, like, put water in your system if it has caffeine in it, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know what I'm saying? So it did hydrate me. It didn't do anything for me. It didn't do anything for anybody. I mean, we didn't have any water. We didn't have any access to water. We didn't have any access to, like, get phone calls or communicating with people. You know what I'm saying? At this time, my parents are bugging out. Consequently, somebody had called my uncle. My uncle is a member of the NAACP, the president. And somebody had called him. And essentially to the effect of, and to this day, I think it was a law enforcement trying to get information. Because essentially to the effect of, can you talk a little bit about your nephew?
Oh, no.
And he didn't say nothing, you know?
Yeah.
But it was also one of those things, like, I never asked him to be called, but the fact that someone just called him was also kind of, like, weird to me, you know?
That's,
you know,
crazy. So he was president in like a local area of the NAACP?
Yeah, he was the president of the Willow Grove branch. And, like, and somebody had just called him, like, out of the blue. It was like, oh, you know, your nephew's in jail. You know, do you know anything about this? You know, so to me, I mean, I you know, when I think about it, I just think about, like, there could have been something going on, you know, beyond, like,
yeah.
the police department. But,
yeah.
But also, I mean, like, just to get back to, like, the jail experience, too, was just, like, the jail was fun, because, like, we were just, like, there was all sorts of different types of jail solidarity, so people got, like, so, like, people started singing, chanting. The sisters were really holding on strong, you know?
You could hear them?
Yeah, we could hear them. And the sisters were really, because the way we were situated, we were to the left. I think that we were to the right, and the sisters were in the main cells of the roundhouse. And when we were getting processed, like, they were fingerprinting us or whatever, we could hear them. You know what I'm saying? Well, in fact, when I got in from jail, they could, what do you call it? They saw me, they started to sight. Like, you know, I remember seeing one of the trans sisters being, like, very much like, Cassandra, hey, yay, you know? So it was good. It felt really good. I mean, it felt like everybody was holding each other accountable and looking out for each other, you know?
Yeah.
And people didn't go easily. I mean, people were, like, dragged, you know what I'm saying? Like, they had to drag some people out of their cell. You know, some folks got naked. Some folks just, like, gave their names. Some folks were really resistant to a point, you know?
Yeah.
You know, in fact, when they took me out of the cell, they brought four officers to the cell. You know, and like, you know, and as we were getting dragged out, this anarchist brother who I don't remember his brother's name, and you know, I haven't seen him since that time, but he locked arms with me. You know what I'm saying? So they had to bring him off and drag me out. And that was, and like, to me, I mean, that was like the spirit of solidarity that right there, you know? I mean, because it was just like, you know, this is somebody I didn't even know, you know?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, this is what I'm thinking, right? Like, some of these lessons are like, there's the question of, like, you know, the trauma that people went through, and then there's the question of, like, you know, the solidarity in our resistance. And then there's really, like, it just made me think about, like, what you said about, you know, or what when we were talking about what a threat it was that, like, these movements were coming together. And I'm thinking, like, really, you know, this could really be, like, a positive, you know, sort of lesson or, like, a roadmap for, like, what to do in the future when, like, you know, when the opportunities arise, like, as far as, like, having a revolutionary vision, like, what are the tools that we can use again, you know? Like, even with the spokes councils, I think that was the only time. It was that in A16. Like, I don't think I ever experienced spokes councils since, but, like, different things that we can bring back in the future and just, like, sort of celebrating some of the, so how far we got, you know?
Right. You know, I know, I dig it. You know, I totally dig what you're saying, because I feel like, you know, I mean, I think that a lot of folks went through a lot of trauma and, like, you know, I mean, it's hard to look back at that time because it was, like, because right afterwards, like, I think that people, like, in SLAM, like, went on this kind of, like, deep break, you know what I'm saying? Like,
mm-hmm.
Folks got really reflective, I felt like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, because people went through, like, a lot of trauma, you know? And, like, so people got really reflective. And, like, and it was unfortunate because, like, a year after this happens, Bush gets in the office and then 9/11 happens. So the whole entire tone and strategy of the world changes. You know what I'm saying? And I think that, I think that people, you know, I think if I would compare now, back then to now, I think back then people were a little bit more patient with each other. You know what I'm saying? Even though we were driving each other, like, insane.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, we were like, you know, this person's my comrade. This person's my sister, my brother, you know? You know, and we're going to try to work something out, you know? Because there were some difficult people within our own affinity group, but we never, like, kicked them out. You know what I'm saying? Like, we struggled with them. And I feel like now, you know, I'm not exactly sure. You know, I think that level of patience needs to be renewed. And I also think that one of the things that we get is just through, like, just the human contact and the talking. I mean, it's also very funny that this stuff happened, like, when the Internet was under this very formative stage. You know, like, so, like, we didn't have Facebook around to organize these actions. You know what I'm saying? We did use the Internet, though. You know, like message boards or whatever, but not as much as, you know, now, you know?
Yeah.
So the focus was pretty much on the face-to-face. Hager said something to the effect of the arduous patience laboring of the negative, you know, that patient work of, like, being together, eating together, talking to each other, struggling with each other, you know, and learning from each other, you know? Because it was something really kind of, for me, like the Dan folks had a lot of access to information in terms of, like, doing this type of work and doing this type of, like, you know, civil disobedience, you know, and direct action. But what we brought to it, too, was this level of direct action, but we also brought this analysis that connected, like, you know, feminist critiques and like, you know, racist critiques to the globalization agenda, you know. And then, like, then you had the peace movement with whom, like, I don't think you can really talk about, like, the R2K without talking about the Quakers. Because the Quakers were the ones who were, like, staffing the lounges. So when I got out of jail, like, I had a place to go and food.
The Friends Center, yeah. And they gave us an office for jail solidarity that we had for 2 or 3 weeks.
Exactly. You know what I'm saying? So people could come in and be like, you know, eating food and, you know, resting and, like, drinking juice or whatever, you know? Like, you know, and it, you know what I'm saying? And that part itself was amazing, you know? And, like, I think that those are the type of things that happened when you, and I felt like that's what happens when you have a movement, you know, of folks moving forward, you know?
Yeah, just being able to really cover different areas of the work and the analysis, like, and then bringing it together in a respectful way, huh?
Yeah, exactly. You know what I'm saying? And, like, you know, and folks really kind of jamming in a sense. You know what I'm saying? Like, it felt very good.
Did you say jamming?
Yeah, jamming.
Yeah.
It was just like, you know, because I remember afterwards, like, I don't know how this happened, but, like, you know, somebody had approached us. I think it was me and Anna. And they were like, you know, we want you to say something to this Quaker group about what the work has meant. Because I think they had, like, the Quaker convention or, like, a Friends convention meeting or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And it was weird because I just got out of jail. And I was still waiting for folks to come out, and I was like, hey, you know, and they were like, oh, you know, you should speak in front of these Quakers, you know, while I was talking, I told the Quakers, I was like, look, you know, you guys are, like, really living up to the word of the Bible, like, y'all, like, welcome some folks in that you don't have to ever know. They appreciated that, you know, and, like, and I appreciated them immensely. You know, and I appreciate all the friendships I formed over these years. I mean, some of the folks that who I went to R2K for, I see them at demonstrations now and again. You know what I'm saying? We still talk and we still hang out, you know? I think that was a very, like, moving experience for many of us, you know?
Yeah. I always thought we were going to get a chance to, like, really practice some of the tactics and strategy we were using and, like, really get better at it and, like, keep going with it. But in some ways, I feel like people also, like, after 9/11, people returned to more, like, community organizing and sort of building, even if it wasn't as militant, maybe, like, deeper roots of organizing. And, like, maybe that could be, like, some of the groundwork for really next time there's, like, a really militant upsurge, having more, like, more of a deeply rooted base.
I think that's the lesson that we need to learn, is that, direct action is so central to the work of this, dismantling state and dismantling capitalism. Direct action done correctly can foster solidarity across racial and gender lines. And that's something that we definitely learned. We really need to maintain, like, the sense of communication and national network, and be really innovative in terms of strategy. I think that one of the things that we consistently talk about, we consistently go back to Seattle, the world has changed in Seattle, and they're learning, the police state's learning curve has increased in Seattle. What are we going to do in terms of, like, reimagining, like, our tactics, and consistently be moving on terms of our tactics, and those are the things we need to focus on, and what are those issues? I still think that the prison issue is a big issue to us, because, like, when you talk about prison abolition and you talk about prison, like, restorative justice, you're really talking about, like, how do we provide solutions to this society? We have a situation in New York State where New York State is a leader, the more mentally ill people in New York State prisons there are in hospitals. Then you basically have a society that's just dealing with issues of mental health with jail.
Mm-hmm.
Prison abolitionism, restorative justice really looks at how do we shift those paradigms, into a more, liberatory practice. And also this liberation within a society, And I think that's some of the stuff that we got out of R2K. Out of R2K, too, also came the birth of Critical Resistance East. The Critical Resistance East Conference happened right after R2K. And all these other great, like, prison abolitionist work, So I think that is also something that was very important for us, as political work, because I think that it did help foster, regional and national conversations on race and incarceration as well. It also taught us the way in which we can also, like, practice solidarity, with social prisoners, I was involved in general population organizing, but I think that, like, for us to talk about prison solidarity, one thing we learned was that, in order for us to talk about it, we also have to be there as well. I think that one thing you notice is that they've cut all these programs, education programs in the prison, and it's not just to deny prisoners the process of growing, but also deny them contact, with people on the outside, because you had a situation in, like, the 70s and the 80s where, like, folks were going into prison all the time doing prison work.
Right, and this separates, it's like their whole thing of, like, they not only disrupt the communities on the outside by sending so many people away to prison, but then they, like, isolate people from communication to where those movements are disrupted also.
Exactly. So those are some of the things I'm just kind of thinking of right now. It's like the prison workers, and there's something I'm thinking about now too, because I'm thinking about doing more prison solidarity work now.
Awesome. Yeah.
It's been a while for me, but it's also been something I've been kind of wanting to focus on. It's been coming more and more into my consciousness, the more I think about it,